This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. President Donald Trump visited Kenosha, Wisconsin this week. Even as demonstrations continue over the recent police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, and a subsequent shooting in which a white teenager opened fire on Black Lives Matter protesters in the region, killing two. U.S. presidents have not, by and large, demonstrated a strong grasp on the subject of race relations. Stephen Jones recently co-wrote an essay published on the website The Conversation, titled, "Presidents Have a Long History of Condescension, Indifference, and Outright Racism Toward Black Americans." Jones is an adjunct instructor of history at Central Michigan University. Stephen Jones, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So President Trump went ahead with his visit to Kenosha at a time when America is really divided. There are many people who support Black Lives Matter, but some white people and even some people of color see images of protests and they feel uneasy. What are some things that a presidential visit might have accomplished at a time like this?
It might have accomplished some calming if that was the demeanor of the visit, if there was, you know, an indication of sincere concern that recognized that whatever the specific facts of the initial shooting, that this series of events in Kenosha are part of a much, much bigger picture that has to be factored into our thinking when we try to approach how to deal with a particular incident. And a display of genuine concern, of some understanding of that complexity, can be helpful, I think, in persuading the American public that there's some thoughtful deliberation going on in how to respond to and how to deal with the specific circumstances in Kenosha or some other place where some of these incidents have happened.
The schedule included a visit to the site of some protests, a tour of an emergency operations center, and a roundtable in which a reporter asked two black ministers about systemic police violence, and President Trump jumped in and answered for them, stating he doesn't think it's an issue. He did not visit Jacob Blake's family. What do you think he accomplished?
Well, I think, you know, I did not see that specific exchange, but if he did, as you described, jumped in and spoke for the black ministers, he added to the problem. Part of the problem that we face as a nation in dealing with issues of race is that for a long, long time, white people have not really been listening to black people when it comes to how they perceive these issues. You know, ideally, President Trump would recognize that whether he sees it as an issue is not nearly so important as him recognizing that the African-American community certainly sees it as an issue. And, you know, that's, you know, until we recognize that, until we have leaders who can see that and recognize and acknowledge that the African-American community has a perspective that is built on a long, long history of being treated disrespectfully and in many cases very brutally by authorities in police departments all over this country, we're not going to be able to resolve any of these issues. We won't be able to move forward until we acknowledge all of that.
You and your colleague wrote this essay that I mentioned, giving a historical survey of some 19th and 20th century presidents and talking about their attitudes toward race. What was the unifying theme for you among all these case studies?
Well, for me, the unifying idea is that we have to be much more thorough and deeper in our thinking when we look at the role of presidents. One of the comments on the that we got on that article was that someone objected to us mentioning, say, Ulysses Grant, who once owned a slave, with someone like Woodrow Wilson, who was a thoroughgoing white supremacist. I mean, he was dignified in his language, in his use of language, but he, you know, segregated federal offices in D.C. and refused to come out in opposition to lynching, or at least when he finally did, it didn't recognize that African Americans were the main targets of lynching. And it's true that all of the presidents, each president has his own particular strengths and or weaknesses. I mean, Grant did own a slave. He, for about a year, year and a half, before he freed that slave. Mm-hmm. And it was a slave that had been given to him by his father-in-law. And Grant undeniably did an awful lot through winning the Civil War, but also sending federal troops into the South as president to help restrain the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations that were attacking African Americans. But still, you know, there was, you know, he was also a product of his time. I'm not a specialist on Grant, but I'm not aware that he ever expressed an idea that whites and blacks were equal. Mm. And so what we have to do is we have to avoid lionizing our former presidents and recognize the totality of their records and recognize the extent to which their leadership has either contributed to the problem or not been effective in resolving the problems of race in America.
A lot of people may have heard that Abraham Lincoln's views on Black Americans were, as you say, complex. I mean, he made pivotal decisions about slavery and the future of Black Americans during the Civil War, but he did not believe that Black Americans were equal to white ones. But that was not a huge surprise in the essay. But there was some very interesting information in there about another president who followed Lincoln, who undid much of the work of abolition. Can you explain what was going on in America when Rutherford B. Hayes was campaigning to become president?
Yes, the presidential election of 1876 was, until 2000, was the most contested election. There have been some very contested elections, but this one was a real cliffhanger in the same way that the election in 2000 was, where several states electoral votes were being challenged, and it, you know, went to Congress to have to decide, and it was, you know, there was this haggling back and forth, and it was dragging on, and finally there was a deal cut whereby the Democrats would accept Hayes as the person elected. They would stop disputing the electoral votes in a way that would allow Hayes to become president. But the payoff for that was that he agreed to basically have the federal troops stand down in the South. You know, the progress that, to the extent that Grant had sent troops in, and there were, I mean, there were congressional hearings. There were just vicious and brutal attacks on African Americans in the South. I mean, just murders and mass killings, and, you know, throughout the Reconstruction period. And after. And Hayes, although he spoke in his inaugural address of ensuring fairness and equity to African Americans as well as to whites, you know, the deal that he cut assured that they would not be protected in the South, and that whites would be able to reestablish white supremacy all across the South, which is what they did. And over the next two decades, they effectively, I mean, they're been about 2,000 African Americans elected to public office, you know, most, the vast majority of them in the South. By 1900, they were virtually, Black office holders were essentially non-existent. And several thousand African Americans had been lynched. And the number of African Americans who were able to vote in the South, like in Louisiana, the one place I'm aware of some numbers, was reduced between two presidential election cycles by something like 90%. And so was all the result of Hayes cutting the deal to become president.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Stephen Jones. He teaches history at Central Michigan University and recently co-authored an essay on U.S. presidents and how they've handled issues of race. There is so much cringeworthy material that you put forward in the essay, and it really stretches over a long period of time. As I was reading it, I was thinking about how even a president like Barack Obama, as historic as he was, you know, sometimes progressives look at what happened during his time in office and say he was not able to make systemic change. you know, because he was the first. Mm-hmm. Do you think that civil rights has ever been more than a talking point in terms of presidential politics?
Oh, yeah, I think it has. But I think that the attention that civil rights have been given, you know, it often, the discussions often get derailed in a variety of other political matters. But the most prominent example that comes to mind quickly was the election of 1948, when Harry Truman, who was a Southerner, I mean, he was from Missouri and had been raised, you know, by a grandma, you know, grandmother who just like thought of Abraham Lincoln as the devil. And so he grew in the office of the presidency. And when he saw the way that African-American veterans were being treated, were being lynched in a number of cases in Southern states in the wake of the war, he grew in his commitment to being the president of all the people. And he set up a commission on civil rights. He issued an executive order finally desegregating the military. And he did so at considerable political risk. He almost lost the election of 1948 because of his assertive stand on civil rights. The so-called Dixiecrats walked out of the Democratic convention and ran Strom Thurmond for president on a third-party ticket and won, I think, four states. So Truman paid a political price, but he made the commitment. But still, there was a man who personally, I mean, you know, he still used the N-word in the White House. He was a complex man, and we need to recognize that. I mean, that our leaders of all political stripes are human beings. They are shaped by the societies they live in. They sometimes, without even being aware of and recognizing how they have been shaped by racial attitudes, will take positions that, you know, that are not as enlightened as would be ideal.
When you are in the classroom, I wonder how much you find your students know about the depth of United States race relations. You know, by the time they reach the undergraduate level, do they know much of the history that you would want them to have as a grounding for this?
Actually, no. I mean, they know some of the broad strokes. They've heard of the Emancipation Proclamation, but they'll give you the shorthand version that Lincoln freed the slaves, which isn't quite right. He did and he didn't. And that's what I try to point out to them. It's a very complex issue. You know, the proclamation only applied to those parts of the country that he had no control over.
Right.
And yet it helped prevent Britain and France, who desperately wanted Southern cotton, prevented by starting to make the war about slavery rather than just preserving the Union. It kept them out of trying to press for a negotiated settlement. And that accelerated the process. It also gave slaves more motivation as they saw Union Army forces approaching to run away on their own. So it is a complicated story. And, you know, and so the students know some of that, but they don't know, there are a lot of things they don't know. For example, Rosa Parks, I mean, they are startled oftentimes to find out that she wasn't just some poor old middle-aged woman who was tired from the day's work and was too tired to get up from her seat and let a white man sit down. As Rosa Parks herself said on more than one occasion, I think I've got the quote right, the only tired I was tired of being pushed around.
Yeah, the incident was sort of crafted with intention to bring attention to the problem.
And she had been a civil rights activist, civil rights and labor activist, for 20 years by the time she got arrested. They're not aware of that. They look at the civil rights movement and they're aware of Martin Luther King and the March on Washington, but they don't understand that King and his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, didn't constitute anywhere near the totality of the civil rights movement, that there were many other organizations involved, and that he didn't lead all the marches. I mean, the lunch counter sit-ins that are so iconic, you know, King wasn't directly involved for the most part in that, certainly not in their origin. Those were started by college students.
Right.
And so you had a lot of young people, one of whom was John Lewis, you know, God rest his soul, who had the youth and the energy and the commitment to go out on their own and start some of the protests. And the students don't generally know a lot of that. And so I try to fill them in. And sometimes I'll get comments, you know, particularly I remember one when I was talking about Rosa Parks and her actual background, students saying, why are we just learning about this now? And they were history majors in college. And so, you know, we don't pay enough attention to it. We don't teach our children enough about the depth and complexity and extent of the struggle that this country's been involved in since the founding. Since its founding, we've been struggling over this issue of civil rights. Who's entitled to the rights of citizenship? Who gets the freedom that we say we stand for? And it saddens me, not just to see how little my students know, but because I know that that reflects how little the whole country, particularly white America, really understands about this.
Stephen Jones is an adjunct instructor of history at Central Michigan University and recently co-authored an essay on U.S. presidents and how they've handled issues of race. Thank you so much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.